You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a children's author who visited Wisconsin schools for the Read on Wisconsin program.
First, the Zika virus is still in the news with concerns over the outbreak in Brazil as the Summer Olympics gets closer. And there have been two cases showing up here in Wisconsin affecting travelers who had recently visited Central America.
But Zika isn't the only disease that has health officials worried. There's been a recent rise in yellow fever in parts of Africa, and the world is still watching for a possible return of Ebola.
Our next guest is a UW researcher with a unique perspective on all three diseases. He regularly works in Uganda, which is home to the Zika virus, is on the front lines in the yellow fever outbreak, and helped lead the anti-Ebola effort.
Tony Goldberg joins us now. He's a professor of epidemiology at UW-Madison and associate director for research at the UW-Madison Global Health Institute. Tony, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here, Rob.
Well, as we mentioned, you've done a lot of work in Uganda. You were just there a few months ago, I think. And I understand that's where Zika was first discovered quite a long time ago. Can you talk a little bit about that background of Zika in Uganda?
Sure. Zika is named for Zika Forest. I was just there a few months ago, which is a small forest near the capital of Uganda. And the virus was discovered there in 1947 by a researcher named Alexander Haddo, who was an early virus hunter in a way. He was looking for new viral threats, and he found this virus largely as a result of looking for and investigating yellow fever virus. But he documented it, published on it. It's been known for a while. He didn't think very much of it. And lo and behold, in 2016, here it is.
Yeah, we've talked to you some about trying to get early warning systems in place for diseases that could affect humans, often coming from animal populations. But what is it about a disease that, as you say, was first recorded 70 years or so ago, and all of a sudden having this big outbreak in a different hemisphere?
Yeah, it's frustrating to say the least. There are many diseases we've known about for a long time that we can't predict where and when they're going to break out. For example, Ebola, last year's major viral story. Mm-hmm. We've known about that virus for decades as well, and yet it was very difficult to predict where and when it would break out, and no one would have guessed West Africa. So I think the lesson is that it's, of course, very important to do surveillance and to hunt for new viruses and other new pathogens, but it's not enough. There has to be something else that's going to help us do a better job of predicting what's going to emerge.
And Zika there in Uganda for so long, we've seen how it's affected Brazil and other places in South and Central America, worries in the United States. Is this a threat? Is this a problem in Uganda?
Interestingly, we're not sure, because Zika is there. It's in a lot of sub-Saharan Africa, but it's eclipsed by other causes of fever that are, frankly, more well-known and more day-to-day problems, things like malaria or chikungunya virus or dengue or some of these other diseases that we've also known about for a while. So Zika is there, but we really don't have a good handle on what clinical symptoms it's been causing over the decades. It's so dramatic in South America and Central America because that appears to be an immunologically naive population of people. So it's like the first wave of a new virus coming in and sweeping through a population, which is often very dramatic.
So that means they haven't had decades, centuries maybe, to develop a resistance to this particular virus.
That's right. There maybe hasn't been resistance. It's possible that the virus is taking advantage of an open niche in the mosquito population that's not available in the mosquitoes in Africa. It's another example of how globalization, global travel, and movement of people and insects can create these explosive situations when it comes to disease.
Talking to UW-Madison epidemiologist Tony Goldberg about Zika and other diseases in the news. Are you worried that all the attention to Zika is crowding out attention we should be paying to other worrisome diseases? You mentioned yellow fever and Ebola, for example.
I think there's general concern among scientists that may be the case. We of course, are worried about Zika. It's a major public health emergency. We should still be worried about Ebola. Just yesterday, the WHO declared Guinea to be transmission-free for Ebola, so that's good news, but we can't stand our guard down just yet. Yellow fever is resurging in Central Africa, in Uganda and Angola, and maybe the Democratic Republic of Congo. And we hear these stories emerging now of novel diseases, like there's the South Sudan fever virus, or South Sudan fever that may be caused by a virus. It's like Ebola, but it's definitely not Ebola. We don't know yet what's causing it. So there is a concern that we're playing whack-a-mole, if you will, that these diseases keep emerging and we throw vast amounts of resources towards these individual diseases to develop the vaccines, to develop the therapies, and to institute controls for those diseases. But unless we step back a little bit at the same time and address the underlying root drivers for why these diseases are emerging at such a fast rate, we'll probably still be playing whack-a-mole next year.
Now we, and I'll include the media and the public and probably a lot of policymakers in this, get excited, get anxious when a disease is in the headlines. And I think that's when you see public funding in that whack-a-mole game that you mentioned. So that's one state. And the other state is there's not a disease currently in the headlines, so we're not worried about it. What would be a more stable approach, a more preventive approach that's going to get us out ahead of the next outbreak, whatever it might be?
That's a good question. And I think we started to really learn this lesson during the Ebola outbreak. It became apparent that the reason Ebola got out of hand was not only because of lack of vaccines and therapies, but it was because of a lack of attention that we've paid in the past to healthcare infrastructure, public health reporting, support systems on the ground, cultural and social practices. So I think in addition to the wonderful biomedical research that we do, and we, I mean scientists like those at UW-Madison, there needs to be a complementary approach from policymakers and social scientists who understand how people are moving and behaving on the ground, because that really, it's the behavior and choices that people make on an individual level that are determining which pathogens are transmitted, either between people or maybe from wild animals to people initially.
I've seen some reporting lately that Uganda, again, where you've done a lot of work, has done a pretty good job against diseases like Ebola. They have some good systems in place. And that made me think, you know, sometimes when we in the West look at these diseases, it's how can we in the West go and help them in Africa or South America deal with a disease? Is that only maybe part of the answer? It's that local infrastructure, the local doctors and scientists and local people need to be part of the solution?
I couldn't have said it better myself. Yeah. Uganda, I think, is a model for how developing countries in Africa can invest wisely in public health infrastructure that allows them to respond efficiently to these sorts of outbreaks. We saw this explosive outbreak in West Africa in large part because we did not have the infrastructure on the ground to stop it. There have been Ebola outbreaks in Uganda as recently as 2008. And they were very small and contained. And part of the reason that was the case is that there was a public health infrastructure there, maybe not the most sophisticated one in the world, but enough to report the results quickly and enough to get people from Uganda, doctors and international teams on the ground to basically contain it. And Uganda was one of the countries that contributed, one of the African countries that contributed to the West African outbreak by sending personnel and by providing sort of a model of how one would proceed in these cases. So I've actually, in my years working in Uganda, I think I've learned a lot more about public health responses from my colleagues in Uganda than they've learned from me.
And I know part of what you do is watch for what the next disease might be. And you and a team have a paper just about to be published, I think it is, on a strain of hepatitis. Is that right?
Yeah, so part of what we do in my lab is virus hunting in a way, and we were always interested in discovering new viruses in animals before they make it into people. You know, different people focus on different steps in the process. Some people focus on putting out the fire. We're hoping that we can prevent the fire from starting in the first place. So we did some routine screening of some baboons in Uganda and found a new virus that's related to human hepatitis A virus. We have no idea whether it's a health threat to people or baboons, but it's yet another one of the many examples in the literature of the fact that we really have a very small understanding of all the pathogens or potential pathogens out in nature that can affect humans.
Tony, thanks as always for joining us.
You're very welcome.
That's UW-Madison epidemiologist Tony Goldberg looking at the efforts against Zika, Ebola, and other diseases around the world.
With all of the potential distractions for children in the day-to-day life, tablets and TV and the internet, getting your child to sit down and read can be a tall order.
But Read On Wisconsin is aiming to make sure that children immerse themselves in books throughout the summer with a new selection of books and readings for all age ranges.
Established in 2004 by then Wisconsin First Lady Jessica Doyle, The initiative has grown both online and in the classroom, with educators, librarians, and students coming together to pick books for the program each spring.
One book featured for this summer for intermediate readers is Farmer Will Allen and the Growing Table. It tells the story of Will Allen, who became an urban farming advocate and legend in Milwaukee.
It was written by Caldecott Award-winning children's author Jacqueline Briggs Martin, and she visited a few schools in the area as part of the Read Wisconsin program, and she joins us from our Milwaukee studio. Jacqueline, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, Jacqueline, how did you first get into the business of children's books?
Well, I have two children, and at the time that they were very young, we lived on a farm out in the country in Iowa, where I live. And my husband would leave for work every morning, and we would be there all day. And one thing that we did with our time was read children's books. We loved it. My kids would bring a stack of books down. We'd sit on the couch, and we'd go through the entire stack. And we had so much fun. I thought, I was looking for something that I could do in the early morning or something I could do while my kids were napping, a project that I might be able to get better at. And I thought, we have so much fun reading these books. And I had always loved the sounds of words since I was a child. I thought, I want to write books for kids. So I bought a tablet, and I started writing. And of course, I was reading a lot of books, and I would go to libraries and see what they had, and I would read those books to kind of figure out what I wanted to write about. And that's how I started.
Wow, so it was sort of this lightning bolt that you just sort of knew, this is what I want to do.
I think so. You know, I had enjoyed writing as a child. I loved words, and I had an imaginary playmate as a child. I loved making up stories. So it kind of came together. Oh, I should be doing this. I should be trying this. And the funny thing is, I love spending time with words. If someone said to me, you have to sew an overcoat, I would shoot myself because I don't love doing that. But I can spend all afternoon writing a sentence because I love it.
Well, let's talk about the story about Will Allen. This is one that is dear to us, you know, in Wisconsin and Milwaukee. How did this story first fall into your path?
I grew up on a farm, and I had read about urban farms. The farm I grew up in was a regular rural farm in Maine, a dairy farm. But I had read about urban farms, and I loved the contrast of farming in an urban setting. So I thought I would write a story about three urban farms, one in Brooklyn, one in the Midwest, and one in the West. And I chose Will Allen. I think I read about him when he won the MacArthur Genius Award. And so I researched the Brooklyn, I researched Will Allen, and I researched the West, and I then began to think, well, for kids, three farms is probably too many farms to think about. I'll just choose one. And Will Allen was, its growing power is such a great endeavor. There's so much going on there, and it has so many goals, and it's meeting all of those goals. Plus, Will Allen is planting seeds for urban farms all over the world. He just seemed like the natural one to choose to tell a story of urban farms.
And did you feel, I mean, a lot of time when people are writing biographies or researching someone in particular, they feel kind of close to that person. And in this case, you know, you can talk to Will Allen, ask him about his past, and write about him. Did you feel you really got to know him or got to feel close to him in any way?
I got to know some wonderful details of his story. And I have come to feel close to him as I have lived with this story. And I see him occasionally now because we did the book together. But the fact that he hated gardening as a child, I think is a wonderful detail. I think kids will find that interesting. He hated it, and now he spends all of his time farming and showing other people how to farm.
What do Wisconsin kids make of his story? How do they respond?
I think they love it that he's a Wisconsin person, that he's located in Wisconsin. I think it makes them feel good about where they live. And I don't know, I think it also, the fact that he's farming in a city, I think makes them feel like they can grow things wherever they are. And so many schools I visit have schoolyard gardens. We visited a school in Madison yesterday that has extensive schoolyard gardens, Orchard Ridge. And today we visited the Gainsland School in Milwaukee. And they have a schoolyard garden, and they were eating rhubarb this week. So I think knowing about an urban farm makes kids realize more possibilities than they might have realized without knowing that.
And you're part of this Read On Wisconsin initiative to try to get kids to keep reading during the summer, not to disappear into their devices. What do you think the secrets are for encouraging kids to read?
As a writer, I think the secret is writing the best stories that I can write, stories that will take hold of their imaginations and give them people that they can kind of carry around as neighbors for the rest of their lives.
Oh, that's a lovely way to put it, carry around as neighbors and as friends. I mean, do you think books, when they are that powerful story that kids really bond with, do you think that that is something that we underestimate sometimes, that this can be a powerful lifelong thing? It's not just a kind of a healthy thing for kids to do, a virtuous thing. It does kind of have a real impact.
I think so, and I think it's satisfying. And I think if we had more time, we could have a conversation about the books that we carry with us from our childhood, the books that really made an impact on us. And I think today's children have those books, too.
What is it for you, Jacqueline? What book?
What book do I carry with me?
Yeah.
We did not have a lot of books when I was a child. I lived on a farm, as I told you, but we had a set of books called Bookhouse Books, and I loved the myths and fairy tales. And actually, there's a Wisconsin legend, Paul Bunyan, who was one of my favorites. I just loved the exaggeration of it. And now I realize he was probably a clear cutter or something. But at the time, I loved the tall tale element of it, how many parsnips the blue ox ate. And so I don't think Paul Bunyan was a model for me, but it was a joy to my imagination to think about it.
And what would you say, you know, as we go forward and talk about getting kids to read, what would you tell parents about why books matter?
That's a good question. Well, there's a lot about books that matter. There's a story content. But for picture books, which is what I write, another thing is the experience of sharing the book together. It's a little community, the parent, the reader, and the book. And that's really important. You share the story, you laugh about the story, and you have it to refer to the next day. Remember when we read that story about that farmer who farms in Milwaukee? Why don't we plant some stuff? It just is life-changing, actually.
Jacqueline Briggs Martin is with us, children's author and Caldecott Award winner, and she's been talking about the Read On Wisconsin initiative that is an effort to get kids reading books this summer. And Jacqueline, you've been visiting schools and gardens, and what have you been learning? Because I know these are not just learning experiences for kids, but for the authors, too, the people who visit schools.
Oh, yes. It is a wonderful learning experience for me. And what I have been learning is that these kids in these schools are really enthusiastic readers. They read and they take it in to themselves and they share it with me when I come to their school. And they also, I think many of them, are enthusiastic writers. And that is really another wonderful side of reading. It makes you a better writer. And whether or not you grow up to be a creative writer, it's important to be able to express yourself, to be able to express your feelings, express your ideas. So that's another thing that I have learned, which has made me feel really good about the schools that I have visited. These kids are readers and they are writers.
Do you think there is sort of a, maybe mental health is too strong a word, but a happiness quotient for kids who do write and express those feelings in writing and in, you know, the books that they read?
I think it's very satisfying, and I think it gives them joy. And I think when they talk with me about the books they've read, whether they're my books or somebody else's books, there's always pleasure. There's always pleasure in that conversation. So, yeah, I think, how can it not be good to have a book that you love to go to after a bad day or after a good day?
So here it is. It's almost summer. A lot of kids getting out of the next week or two. What do you think you would give them as a book list? And some of your own, maybe it could be on that list. But what would you, any titles you'd give parents to say, here, this is going to get your kid to read, even though it's summertime?
Well, I cannot best the book list that the CCBC has put together for Read On Wisconsin. It's got wonderful books on it. And the CCBC website has other book recommendations. So I think parents who have access to the internet can go to the CCBC Read On Wisconsin page and find wonderful books. Some of my favorite books are written by a Wisconsin person, Kevin Hankus.
Yeah, he's been on the show.
Yeah, and he lives in Madison. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think. Now that you ask me, of course, it's hard for me to come up with titles. I also love the classic picture book writer, Maurice Sendak. And some of the books that aren't as well known but are really wonderful is A Nutshell Library by Maurice Sendak. You can put The Nutshell Library in a raincoat pocket, but it's got some really wonderful books in it. And they are ageless. He wrote them, I don't know, probably 30 or 40 years ago, but there's so much fun that I think that would be a great pick.
Jacqueline,
parents.
Great recommendations. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Jacqueline Briggs Martin, the author of several children's books, including Farmer Will Allen and The Growing Table. She's been talking to us about the Read On Wisconsin initiative and more. That program is one to get kids reading books this summer. And if you want to check out those lists that she was talking about, you can go to readon.education.wisc.edu.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up tonight after 7, it's storytelling on the Moth Radio Hour. A woman visits a fortune teller and is told she's cursed. A stay-at-home mom contemplates becoming a minister. And the father of an autistic child describes his son's perilous adventure. That's tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
Now, federal regulators propose new rules today that would put tighter restrictions on payday lenders. Think check into cash, quick cash, title loans. The new rules target lending practices that many consider predatory and lead people into cycles of debt.
Payday, auto title, and other short-term lenders have come under criticism over the last few years for having extremely high annual interest rates that can be 300% or higher. Here's a clip of President Obama criticizing payday lenders last year.
At first, it seems like easy money, but the average borrower ends up spending about 200 days out of the year in debt. You take out a $500 loan at the rates that they're charging at these payday loans, some cases 450% interest, you wind up paying more than $1,000 in interest and fees on the $500 that you borrowed.
That was the president talking about payday lenders in Birmingham, Alabama last year. And we want to hear about your experience with this. Have you ever turned to a short-term lender like this? Tell us what happened and give us a call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Did you find yourself struggling to pay back your loan, or did turning to a payday lender end up helping you in the long run? Call 800-642-1234.
Joining us now to tell us about the new proposed regulations is Prentice Cox. He's an associate professor at the University of Minnesota School of Law. Prentice, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's look at these new guidelines from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. What would change under what was unveiled today?
The big change is an ability to pay rule. That means that when you make one of these payday or auto title loans, you have to obtain information from the consumer sufficient to allow the lender to determine that the consumer can pay the loan back.
That was one of the changes, and a couple other parts. Three basic parts here. What else changed in this new guideline?
Well, that's really the most important one. Everything else is an alternative way of making a loan to doing the ability to repay, but it's all based off that fundamental ability to repay. And the reason that's so important is that the problem with payday loans is that people get caught in these debt traps. They get the loans, and the reason the lenders are willing to make it is they get to stand first in line to grab the person's paycheck or car or whatever. So it's not done like a traditional loan where they make sure that you have the ability to pay the loan before they give it to you. And so what the new rules do is they're attempting to make sure that only consumers who can pay back the loan are given the loan. Now, there are alternatives, and it depends on whether it's a loan that's 45 days or less or 45 days or greater. But in all cases, there has to be some assurance that this isn't going to be the kind of loan that will put people into a debt trap.
And let's talk about that concept of the debt trap. Can you describe the life cycle of somebody getting one of these payday loans and ending up in sustained debt, ending up paying a lot more money than over time than they borrowed in the first place?
Yeah, that's the real fundamental problem with these loans. People say, well, it's only a two-week loan. But actually, the typical borrower will take out about 8 or 10 of these loans. And that means they pay the upfront fees for each of those loans. So borrowers caught in this debt trap wind up paying it back more money to the lender than they actually borrowed in a fairly short period of time. Just in a few months, they've already paid more in fees and interest than the amount of money they borrowed.
Fees and interest and sometimes penalties, as I understand, if loans aren't paid in time, that can be really pretty substantial and then add into that debt load again.
Yeah, and the penalties come not only from the payday lender, but one of the ancillary things the rules is trying to get at is this problem where borrowers give lenders the authority to hit their account when the money's supposed to be there. And if they do it and the money's not there, then payday lenders have typically just kept resubmitting that request for money. And every time they do that, the borrower's bank hits them with a fee, often about $25 or $30 or $35.
Talking to Prentice Cox from the University of Minnesota School of Law, looking at new guidelines unveiled today by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, a new-ish federal agency affecting the way payday lenders do business. I want to go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Jimmy is on the line in Maquoketsu. Jimmy, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I think, it's a catch-20. For me personally, there was an opportunity in my life where, there was a short period of time where I knew I had a guaranteed amount of income coming over like a 60-day period, but it wasn't there in that 10-day period that I needed to stay current on some debt. And so I borrowed $2,500, and it cost me $500 per month. And my original plan was to only keep it for a month, but I think I understand the concern is I ended up having to keep it for 2 months. And so it cost me $1,000 instead of $500. And so I think we need to be conscientious as loan consumers to make sure that we're set up to repay the loan.
Jimmy, thanks a lot for the call. And Prentice, that's something some people have said, that maybe the onus should be on the consumer to be savvy enough, read the fine print, and know what they're getting themselves into. The case here from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is that is not enough. So why would that not be enough, Prentice?
Well, payday loans are typically people who, your caller is actually not the typical payday loan or small dollar lending customer. It's usually people who are pretty desperate for the money. They're facing a tremendous amount of stress financially. And so the question is, do we just say, just like no usury limits, as happens in Wisconsin and a few other states, do we just throw people out to the market and say, it's up to you, buyer beware? Tough luck if you get yourselves in over your head, even though we know that in this kind of borrowing, people are going to wind up in debt traps and they're going to wind up paying an exorbitant amount of money for getting these small loans. So it's what you think is appropriate. I think in setting up the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the Congress at the time, in response to the financial crisis, made the decision that we weren't going to let unfair and abusive practices happen in the marketplace. And to me, this is a classic case of an unfair and abusive practice.
Bring on another caller now. We've got Natalie on the line in Milwaukee. Natalie, hi. What did you want to tell us about, Natalie?
Well, I worked at a bank for a couple of years here in Milwaukee, and as a banker, I saw lots and lots of customers who were coming in to open new accounts because their entire paychecks were getting sucked out from their previous account by these payday lenders. And if you have a family or even just yourself, they weren't able to afford their food, their diapers, all of those things that they need, the basic necessities, because they built up so much interest and fees like you were talking about. And then by opening those accounts and having banks close them because they built up so many bank fees from having the payday lenders continually charge the accounts, they're permanently damaging their credit. So it ends up being a cycle that makes it less likely for them to be able to get lending from a reliable bank or credit union in the future.
Interesting, Natalie. Thank you so much. Prentice, is that part of a life cycle of a loan that we do often see, that not only is this eating up people's entire paychecks, but probably ruining their credit history for the future?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the caller does a great job of describing it. What happens is that not only do you owe this money, but a key piece of the payday lending problem, which the rule directly tries to address, particularly in some of the more nuanced parts of the rule, is that they have what the rule calls leverage payment options, which means it's a long way of saying that the payday lender gets to stand in line first. And that's what makes this lending different than other lending. If you can't pay back your auto loan or your mortgage or your credit card, you get to decide which lender you're going to pay when. With your auto loan, of course, they can repossess your car if you're late. But, you get to decide how you're going to allocate your money. Problem with payday loans is that when you go and get the loan, you give them the right to stand first in line the day your paycheck comes or your benefit check comes, et cetera. And that changes the lending dynamic and switches the power from the borrower to the lender in terms of when they do it. And so they empty people's accounts and they get extra fees, and they wind up often, which is what the caller was talking about, they often actually lose their ability to get a checking account, because they have their checking accounts forced closed by the traditional banks, and then they have a hard time opening up a new one.
Natalie, thanks for that call. And she mentioned people, the entire paycheck going to the payday lender, not being able to meet the basic necessities of life. As I understand in these new guidelines unveiled today, the condition for making these short-term loans isn't just can you repay it, but can you repay it and still meet the necessities, the basic day-to-day necessities of your life? That's what the lender would have to consider now.
That's correct. Yeah, they have to. It's very clear in the rules. They have to look at your housing costs, and they have to look at basic, costs of living and your other debt expenses. And then they can only make a loan to you if you have the capacity to pay back the loan, when considering all those factors.
We're talking to Prentice Cox. He's an associate professor at the University of Minnesota School of Law, looking at federal guidelines proposals to put more restrictions on payday lenders.
And we want to hear from you. Tell us where you've had to turn when you're in a financial bind by giving us a call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us if you've ever turned to a place like title loans, check into cash, or other short-term lenders, and what was that experience like? Were you able to pay back the loan, and would you do it again? Call 800-642-1234.
We're picking up our conversation now with associate professor at the University of Minnesota School of Law, Prentice Cox. We're talking about proposed restrictions on payday lenders that were announced by federal regulators earlier today.
And we'd love to hear from you on this. Have you ever turned to a payday lender when you were in a financial bind? Did you ever have to maybe put your car up as collateral or give access to your checking account? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. What do you think of these new regulations? Maybe you work in the short-term lending industry. You can call us at 800-642-1234.
And back to our callers now with Janie on the line in Madison. Janie, hi.
Hi. Interesting topic on the show, and I'm glad to hear that there's some regulations happening, though I don't think they're strict enough. I myself have never gone through a payday loan. I have seen people who have. In fact, I had a friend many years ago that they had illness in their family. They did a title loan, wound up losing their car, and she in turn wound up losing her job because she couldn't get there without a car. and had a judgment against her, and it really ruined her. Myself, many years ago after a divorce when I was a young lass in my 20s, I had a super high interest car loan from a less than stellar lender because I didn't have a choice at the time. And while I owned the car, I had the engine go out, which was a pretty extensive and expensive repair, and I had no choice but to go back to this lender and ask for additional monies to be tacked on to this loan, which they were happy to do. And it took me forever to pay it off, and I wound up paying way more than the value of the car and certainly more than the value of the repair in the end.
Janie, thanks a lot for that call. And Prentice, a lot there we could talk about. I want to mention her point that she brought up early, not strict enough. And that's what some consumer groups are saying, that these new regulations don't go far enough.
Yeah, and I'm sympathetic to that. But here's the deal. These are federal rules passed under the general authority given to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to prohibit unfair and abusive practices. They aren't the end of the discussion. They just set a federal floor. There are about, depending on how you count it, about 15 states that prohibit this sort of lending altogether, usually by having an interest rate cap that's 36% or sufficiently low to prevent this lending. So in a lot of states, the rules really don't make any difference because there isn't any of this lending. It's more aimed at the states that do have it, that don't have the regulations. And if you think it should go farther, which many people do, then it's time to go to your state legislature and ratchet up the power to have your state join the other states that just prohibit the lending. I will note Wisconsin's one of the states with no usury limit, so it has by far some of the highest payday lending costs in the country, which is an important point. Because this is a perverse market, because this doesn't work like typical markets, when you get more competition, the price doesn't go down. In fact, what happens is the opposite, is that where you have laws that allow higher charges, you see a flood of payday lenders come in. You don't see the price drop. You just see more payday lenders. So when you cross the bridge from Minnesota to Wisconsin, you know, you immediately are hit with auto title lenders, payday lenders, that kind of thing, are sitting right across the border because they can charge more.
Janie, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Prentice, do you see a movement one way or another in states? Are more states putting new restrictions on payday lending, or are states who have those restrictions backing away from them?
It's definitely a movement toward restricting, either getting rid of or tighter restrictions on payday lenders. There was a time when you saw states move the other way, you know, during the period when Wisconsin abolished its usury restrictions. But in the last 10 years, the pendulum has swung. Interestingly, whenever restricting payday lending goes up for a vote, voters almost, I don't think there's any case where voters have failed to restrict payday lending when given the chance, even in what would be called red states. And you've seen this happen in Arizona or purple states like Ohio. It doesn't matter how those states vote in presidential elections. When given the chance, the voters put the kibosh on payday, on high-cost, small-dollar lending.
Talking about payday lending and new regulations with Prentice Cox from the University of Minnesota School of Law. The industry says, and supporters say, well, you know, even if this isn't a perfect deal, there's a need here. People sometimes need a short-term loan. Banks don't do it, often can't do it. Unless you want to go to, criminal loan sharks, it's the only possible option. What do you say to that? Is there anything else out there? Should there be something else out there for people to go to if it isn't these payday lenders?
Now, ideally, what we would have is we would move this small-dollar lending into the traditional depository banking system. That's ultimately the best thing to happen, and to have it based on all the data that the bank already has about you, so allowing efficient, quick, lower-cost underwriting. But we haven't really gotten there yet. There are a lot of credit unions who have begun to offer these products, and hopefully we'll figure out how to make that mainstream. You do raise a point, though. I mean, I think that the argument isn't a slam dunk for getting rid of payday lending. There's a reasonable positions on both sides. There is a need for access to small dollar lending, but it's also true that the consequences of that lending can be brutal when it's unregulated. And what I think makes sense about these rules is that they take away the worst parts of payday lending, this giving people money where there's no capacity for them to pay it back, almost guaranteeing that they fall into these debt traps and a cycle of negative consequence. And what you want to do is not make loans in those situations.
Let's go back to our callers with Roy on the line in Oshkosh. Roy, hi.
Hi. I am a attorney in Oshkosh in Green Bay, and I do a lot of my practice in what I would call consumer protection, and I run into it quite frequently where people are caught in these payday lending traps, as you describe them so aptly, anywhere from 600 to 1,000% interest. And in order to get them out of that cycle, I utilize what Wisconsin has in under Chapter 128. It's unique to the state of Wisconsin. It's a statute that allows debtors to put unsecured debt into a 36-month repayment plan at essentially a 0% interest. And this works out quite well for freeing people from this because they can take this $400 loan that has ballooned to $1,000 or $1,500 or whatever it has ballooned to over the course of a few weeks into a 36-month repayment plan. Works out quite well, actually.
Roy, thanks for sharing that with us. Prentice, I'm sure not everyone aware of that option, but I guess the goal of these new federal regulations would be to prevent that situation before having a lawyer who knows to take advantage of a law like that.
Yeah, well, good for I learned something. Thank you, Roy. no idea that law existed, and I've never heard of a law like that, so that's something I'm going to look up. Yeah, and you're right. That's the point of the rules is to make sure you don't get to that $1,000 bill for the $300 loan.
And Prentice, briefly, as we wrap up, payday lending industry representatives say this is going to put a lot of their members out of business, these new proposed federal guidelines, if and when they come into place. Do you think that is a likely outcome in just 30 seconds or so?
Yes, and it's a good one. I mean, we have way too many payday loans. If you're going to have a state that allows payday loans, you want to get down to a much smaller number of people, and you want those people to be people who can actually pay back.
We'll leave it there. Prentice, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you. I enjoyed it.
That was Prentice Cox. He's an associate professor at the University of Minnesota School of Law. He joined us to talk about new proposals from federal regulators out today on payday lending companies. You can still share your thoughts on the idea of new regulations and your experience with payday lending as a consumer or maybe as someone who works in the industry. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page.